when you go through this exercise, you realize, although we don't know who developed Bitcoin, Bitcoin would not exist without academic research. And this is true of so many different parts of the blockchain industry, that they have relied critically on concepts developed by academic researchers.
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Join us as we delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver market insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit subscribe for your bi-weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto's a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid anytime, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently.
Welcome, everybody, to this episode of the FCAT Crypto Brief. I am Jason Ward, and I'm here today with co-host Matt Allen. And we are welcoming two guests today to talk about collaboration between Fidelity and academia, and also the importance of research. So please join me in welcoming Kasala Yapa and Ari Jules. So Ari and Kasala, we're very happy to have you guys come in and talk with us, but maybe you could just share a little bit about yourselves. I mean, Ari, you're a professor at Cornell Tech, among many other things, and maybe you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and what you've been working on.
Yeah, I'm a faculty member at Cornell Tech. I'm also a co-founder and co-director of the Initiative for Cryptocurrencies and Contracts, or IC3, which is a multi-university research initiative devoted to all things blockchain. And finally, I serve as chief scientist at Chainlink Labs. As for what I've been working on recently, my group has been focusing on, broadly speaking, two different topics. One is the use of what are called trusted execution environments, which we can talk a bit about today in blockchain applications. And the other is voting and DAOs.
That's great. We're looking forward to the conversation. And Kasala, you are an FCAT team member here joining us on the podcast for the first time. So we're delighted to have you. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and what you're currently working on?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Jason. Hello, everyone. I'm excited to be joining you today. I'm based in Ireland. Prior to Fidelity, I had a mix of industry and academic experience spanning software engineering, AI, and blockchain. Currently, within the blockchain incubator, I'm mostly working on MEV, DeFi, and regulatory compliance-related projects.
All right, excellent. And I'm really looking forward to talking about some of the collaboration that we've had and being members of IC3 and the opportunities that that has brought to us in terms of research and advancing our understanding of the technical capabilities. But before I do that, we want to just cover a couple of recent news stories and then spend the bulk of our time digging into the Prof project, getting into that, and then talking about the importance of research in terms of advancing the industry and honestly advancing the human experience. So I'll start out with a quick story about Uber, and then Matt, I want to have you come in and talk a little bit about recent activity in the IPO markets. But I read some stories recently about Uber and Uber's plans to explore utilizing stable coins for their cross-payment activity. So I decided to dig in and say, what is it that they're really talking about? And at a recent Bloomberg Tech Summit, Uber CEO said that they are indeed actually looking at stable coins for international payments. And it turns out, as a company, they've got over 70 countries that they're working in now. So 70 countries, it's a technology-first company, and they're looking at ways to have more efficient cross-border payments. And in the past, the CEO has also talked about their exploration of potentially incorporating Bitcoin into their business. So I think this push towards utilizing cryptocurrencies as a means of exchange or even a store of value in their case, it makes a lot of sense. I think from an user's perspective, it could be seamless if they have the appropriate wallets, just like in linking your card. But we'll see how that unfolds. But I just found that pretty interesting. And because it was stablecoin related, Matt, I thought you could talk to us about the IPO activity from yesterday.
Yeah, certainly. So pretty interesting news yesterday. Circle, the second largest stablecoin issuer by volume, actually debuted their public trading in an IPO yesterday.
This IPO has been long in the making as Circle attempted to go public back in 2021 via a special purpose acquisition vehicle or SPAC. That SPAC ultimately failed due to the SEC not declaring their S-4 or registration prospectus effective in time. And then following the failure of that SPAC, we saw the IPO markets effectively close, right? So markets were down. Companies don't typically want to go public when you have, you know, both high volatility and downward pressure on markets. So with the green light kind of coming on the regulatory front over the past 6 months, and then starting to see markets return to near all-time highs, it was a great opportunity for Circle to go out and debut their IPO. And their IPO actually more than doubled their trading price. They initially started trading at $31 a share, and they ended trading yesterday at over $86 a share. So certainly a lot of excitement from investors trying to get their hands on Circle shares, and definitely bodes well for the IPO market in the future for any other companies that are sitting in private looking to raise public capital.
Thanks, man. I think it's always interesting when you have a new company coming to market. We see trends where publicly traded equities have been decreasing in numbers over the years. So, you know, it's too early to speculate as to whether this enthusiasm is about, you know, just the IPO markets opening themselves or the long-term prospects of any given given company. But either way, I think there is a short-term signal for sure that the regulatory and the environment in the U.S. has improved for crypto companies. And while there's still a lot of work to be done, there's activity being undertaken in the legislative branch as well to try and promote or increase the opportunity for crypto companies and crypto assets to be more widely adopted in the U.S. economy. But it is a bit juxtaposed at times with some of the other things that we're seeing. We'll dive into a little bit later on when it comes down to budgets. And you know, as we have this conversation right now, there's an effort underway to conduct a reconciliation bill for funding of the U.S. government. But that's a big, big topic to get after. And before we do that, I think it'd be fun to start out and talk a little bit more about why Ari and Casale are here today. And I think the relationship between Fidelity, particularly Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, and Professor Jules really had its roots in the IC3 engagement. And if you're not familiar with IC3, it's the Initiative for Cryptocurrencies and Contracts, which is a research organization that's multi-university, multi-industry participants. And frankly, I think was a catalyst for the opportunity for Casale to engage in and what we call PROF. So maybe Ari, if I could ask you to just describe a little bit right now, what is PROF? And how did you draw an interest in getting into this space? And if you want to go back into a little bit into MEV as a kicking off point, please feel free.
Yeah, it makes sense, I think, to explain what MEV is. MEV stands for either minor extractable value or, more recently, maximal extractable value. The term was coined at a time when the Ethereum blockchain in particular used proof of work and therefore had miners. Now that it has validators, people use this other term, maximum extractable value. So what is MEV exactly? Well, MEV stems from a particular feature in the architecture of blockchain systems. Landscape has gotten somewhat more complicated than I think my description will do justice to, but a particular feature in which the transactions that users submit to these systems are publicly visible. They go into what's called the mempool. And that means that other entities can gain advanced knowledge of the trades that users are going to perform. Right? This is not generally true of typical equities markets, for instance, or where it is true, there are regulations in place to protect against the inappropriate use of privileged information. On these blockchain systems, being open systems as they are, provide this advanced knowledge of users' transactions. And as you know, if you have the ability to look into the future to see what trades are going to happen some time from now, you can take advantage of it to make a profit. In blockchain systems, this can happen in a variety of ways. But one common way is through a process known as sandwiching. This is one of the most common forms of MEV that impacts users in a generally a negative way. Well, what is sandwiching? Well, something can come along after observing your transaction in the mempool. And let's say that your transaction involves buying some asset, say Bob's Bubble tokens. I buy up a lot of Bob's Bubble tokens. What this adversarial entity can do is, observing that you're going to buy Bob's Bubble tokens and knowing that the price is going to rise in consequence, is what you or I would do if we knew that the price of some asset was going to rise, buy up some of that asset in advance. In other words, insert a buy transaction for this asset into a block before the user's transaction. And then afterwards, after the price has risen as a result of the user transaction, turn around and sell with a second transaction. The term sandwiching is used because the transactions of the adversary here flank the transaction of the user, and they are, in the sandwich metaphor, the bread of the sandwich, and the user's transaction is the meat of the sandwich. This opportunity, the ability to do this, has had, as it turns out, a huge impact on the way that blockchain systems, particularly smart contract-enabled blockchain systems like Ethereum and many others, Solana and so on and so forth, are architected and on their dynamics in general. So that's MEV. And as you can see, it's a real problem for users. So both Kosala and I have been thinking about how to address this problem, as many others have been. And Prof is a particular solution to the problem that my research group devised and that we've been collaborating on rolling out in practice, at least taking first steps in that direction.
As we do that, I am a bit remiss. I did not explain what PROF was. Could you just tell us what that acronym stands for?
It stands for Protected Order Flow. And in a nutshell, the protection is going to be conferred on user transactions, right? The idea is to protect them against adversarial transactions like those that arise in the sandwich attack.
Excellent. Thank you. And Kisala, can you give us a little bit more info on this?
Yes, thanks, Avi, for the great explanation of MEV. Actually, MEV is a very interesting research project because the MEV has good impacts and bad impacts. In the current DeFi ecosystem, to maintain the price anomalies between various liquidity pools, there are external arbitrage agents running. So basically, we can consider them as good aim because they support the DeFi ecosystem. And also the bad MEV can impact your user transactions and users may need to pay an extra fee. And from an institutional point of view, I was thinking, how can we protect user transactions from external MEV? And also, how can we implement compliance into the transaction supply chain? While I was reading about MEV and also I got an opportunity to join the IC3 blockchain camp in 2023, and I met Arjuls and we had a good chat about the PROF project proposal. And there I clearly realized that project PROF aligns with our research and experiments, and I wanted to join with the team and contribute to its development. And we have since developed and delivered PROF. And PROF right now has landed blocks on the Holoski testnet. Unfortunately, Holoski is not really working right now. We are planning to experiment PROF within our environment and test it on Houdi test network. That's the latest test network.
Excellent. So, you know, it's just an example where within the Center for Applied Technology, as we are exploring new ways to conduct business and understanding the ecosystem itself, if I understand it correctly, there's an opportunity not just for any user, this is open source software, for any users to try to incentivize block proposers to include transactions in a block that have taken advantage of this ordering, this protected order flow that is intended to be achieved using PROF. So very, very interesting. Now, Ari, I think you're one of the a great person to talk about this because, you know, MEV and how the ecosystem has evolved, particularly post validator shift, proof of stake shift. You've had a lot of activity, students close to this, and it seems this is a passion of yours. Can you talk about why fairness matters and how fairness may be different to different people?
Yeah, well, a big research topic in both academia and industry is defining what fairness means. The definition can be quite elusive in almost any context, even in a context like blockchain systems, where you would think there would be some nice objective definition, like fairness means everyone has an equal opportunity to profit from their transactions, right? There's certainly, I think, an intuitive notion of fairness that aligns with the kind of informal definition I just gave, but figuring out what it actually means can be quite tricky. Our group of MEV and transaction fairness began back in 2017 when we published a blog post on some early decentralized exchanges called 0x and EtherDelta. And we pointed out that problems like this sandwiching problem arose in those decentralized exchanges. They looked very different from the way Uniswap looks today. They had their own order books and so on and so forth. But their architecture had real similarities with DEXs as they operate today. And so the MEV problem was arising in that early context. Our goal was to warn people about this possibility in the hope that the community could devise defenses. And unfortunately, that blog post kind of backfired on us in the sense that people didn't contact us asking, how would you suggest that we remedy this problem? Instead, we had developed a demonstration bot, a sandwiching bot, to show that this problem could arise in the context we were discussing. And people contacted us to buy this bot, which, of course, we were not interested in selling. We were interested in using it purely for scientific purposes. And MEV exploitation really began to take off at that point, unfortunately. So the mission of the group, and particularly of my then PhD student, Phil Diane, who's been a leading figure in this part of the industry, kind of shifted to understanding the dynamics of MEV and thinking about ways to address its harmful forms, right? As Kosala has indicated, they're both beneficial and harmful forms, and it's a little hard to draw the line between them. So in 2019, we published a paper entitled Flash Boys 2.0, an homage to the famous Michael Lewis book, Flash Boys, in which we coined this term MEV. And we studied the way that, at that time, bots were taking advantage of it. And so we characterized the behavior of these bots in a game-theoretic way, which happened matched their observed behavior. Phil made this very interesting observation about how MEV could undermine the integrity of consensus. And from this point, the group was trying to figure out ways to address MEV as a problem systemically in blockchain systems. And we have since taken Phil and I and others in the group have taken a diverse range of approaches. And I would say that those approaches have culminated in a practical sense, as far as my group is concerned, in PROF and our collaboration with Fidelity. The design of PROF has been informed pretty critically by some of the important observations that Kosala has made about industry need when it comes to MEV and about regulatory compliance.
Yeah, and Kosala, when you mentioned regulatory compliance a little bit earlier, could you tell us a little bit about activities or ways you're researching that we could improve or ensure that entities who may be proposing blocks are in fact ensuring that they are compliant with their regulatory obligations?
Great point, Jason. Regulatory compliance is a very important topic these days. We are experimenting on how to find underlying services to support more proactive and reactive compliance checking. Block Builder is a very good example. When block building is happening, Block Builder can filter out all these sanctions transactions, sanctioned addresses, involved transactions. And And the relay can also filters out all the sanctioned transactions. In that way, we can filter out all the sanctioned transactions. Right now, we are experimenting with the OFAC sanction list. If we need a regulated environment, if we need to comply with whatever the regulations available right now, so developing underlying services to support proactive and reactive compliance checking.
Excellent. I think I'm going to take one step to zoom out for some of the folks who might not be as familiar with the components that you just mentioned. You talked about block builders, and these are entities that look to the mempool and they'll aggregate transactions and try to sequence them in a way that they believe to be profitable and desirable for relaying or proposing those, or I should say, making those blocks available to the entities that are proposing a block to be included in the network. If a proposer is trying to be economically advantageous, they will look to blocks that give them more transaction fees or have the ability to generate more MEV, for lack of a better description. So if they're economically rational, they'll look for that. But what I think I heard you saying, and Matt, please feel free to jump in it if you have comparisons in the Bitcoin mining space, but there's an opportunity to have that building side focus on ensuring that they don't include any address or any transaction that involves an address that might be listed on a sanctioned address. So your preventative maintenance as opposed to after the fact. And Matt, I would ask, you know, with the Bitcoin mining side, like when people essentially mine blocks, they don't always know what transactions are in the block until afterwards. Is that fair?
Yeah. Well, on the Bitcoin mining side, there's a bit of a similar segregation of work. You know, on the Ethereum side, we call it like block proposers, block builders. Bitcoin mining block construction really occurs at the pool level. And they play that role of block construction. And so I think maybe an interesting question to pose to Casal and Ari is that as part of the Bitcoin mining ethos, there's always been this understanding that there will be sanctioned addresses, but those addresses will pay more fees and eventually some pool will include those addresses. Is that some sort of consideration of like, how do you treat this fairly in prof, right? Is there some sort of prof construction that should at some point include those addresses, or should they always be de facto excluded?
Well, prof can implement any number of policies when it comes to the construction of what's called a bundle. This is the collection of transactions that prof will get included in a block. So it could implement a sanctions regime, but that's not really a fundamental part of its design, let's say, right? It has the flexibility to accommodate these potential regulatory requirements, but that's not really what it's about fundamentally.
Yes, Matt. Actually, that totally depends on the requirements. With prof, we have a protected order flow. So if you have a lot of user transactions, we can add some extra fee with those transactions to create profitable blocks. And we can delegate those transactions through the protected order flow.
Yeah. So I guess I would maybe sort of summarize and say fair isn't always equal. So some entities, if you are regulated, you would probably want to have that type of exclusionary possibility, and other entities may not have that same consideration. So how they would, in theory, create a bundle of transactions may differ. And I do want to take us down into the topic of research. And what we're describing here is some of the output of research. And I will admit, I don't think we've done any justice towards prof yet, because I think prof is super interesting about how it can be incentivizing builders and proposers to include transactions that they may not be able to squeeze for additional value. So an MEV insulation to some extent. And it's really interesting. I think there's a lot to talk about there. But really, we wouldn't even be talking about it without this type of research. And, you know, we acknowledged earlier in the program that although the regulatory environment and the legislative environment seem to be becoming more constructive for the crypto asset space, there is some, I'll say, friction right now or some concern around funding for research. Ari, could you talk to us a little bit about that and your take, given that you are living in this world every day?
Yes. So the federal budget under consideration now would drastically reduce the amount of funding available for scientific research and research and technology across the board. And the figures differ from area to area, but we're talking about essentially a 50% reduction. And this would be unfortunate in all kinds of ways, impacting our ability to deliver medical innovations and so on and so forth. I think the impact will be particularly visible even in the short to medium term in the blockchain industry because of the particularly fruitful collaboration between academic researchers and industry participants. Academic research has been a key part of the engine of innovation in this industry. And if it's defunded, everyone will feel the effects. Some colleagues and I, nine colleagues and I, recently put out an opinion letter on CoinDesk. This was on Monday, in which we enumerated all the technological building blocks and projects and companies in the blockchain or Web3 industry that came about from academic research or were developed by researchers closely aligned with academia. And when you go through this exercise, you realize, although we don't know who developed Bitcoin, Bitcoin would not exist without academic research. And in particular, without academic research going on in the United States with the help of federal funding. Even something as fundamental as digital signatures was developed in academia. And without digital signatures, of course, you wouldn't have Bitcoin. Without hash functions, also developed an academic researcher, essentially, you would not have a Bitcoin. And this is true of so many different parts of the blockchain industry, that they have relied critically on concepts developed by academic researchers. That includes things like zero-knowledge proofs, Byzantine fault-tolerant systems. Much of the groundbreaking work has happened in academia. So I think it's easy to take for granted, because many of the innovations have been around for a while, because academic researchers do their research on a long time horizon. It's easy to take for granted some of the foundational building blocks that academic research has contributed to the blockchain industry. Purpose of our letter was to remind people of the importance of these things. And the innovation cycles, in many cases, in this partnership between academia and industry, are becoming shorter. The collaboration is becoming tighter. Academics are becoming more deeply involved in the industry and better informed of its needs, which is why I say that a reduction in investment in academic research is going to be felt in the short to medium term by the industry as a whole.
Thank you for summarizing that, because I think it is really interesting, right? Because we want to be advancing. We finally have some, I'll say, shifting of the winds. So we feel like they could be at our back, but then again, we're maybe needing to take a new tack as there are things that are coming up that we don't control, but that could have an influence. And Kisala, if I could maybe pull you in for a moment here, you're in a different country. You know, you're working in Ireland. You've been part of that ecosystem for quite a bit. Could you just share with us what your experience is there and sort of how things may be unfolding over in Ireland, if not the broader EU?
Yes, in Ireland, there are Irish government and European Union funded research centers, and which provide a collaborative platform for industry and academia to come together and drive innovation. While I was in the academy, I involved in several projects. And also this year, we initiated a research partnership with the top university in Ireland and the Irish Research Council to work on a research project that I defined, which complement our ongoing research. And also we can provide them kind of good experience about what is happening in the industry.
Thank you. I am very appreciative of the fact that there are different environments. And I would, in the past, talk about the risks of flight of talent and capital based on regulatory arbitrage. I question what might we experience some similar risk from a research perspective if over the long term, the funding for research does get reduced in the US, and then will people be looking for opportunities elsewhere? And what might that signal for us long term? And I'm not trying to project. It's just questioning or raising the question. And frankly, I really hadn't thought much about it myself until RU and I had a couple of conversations in preparing for this podcast. So it is, I think it's important for us to understand and to help highlight ways in which industry and academia are coming together in order to advance the ecosystem, which ultimately can benefit not just the residents of our country, but the residents of the globe. So I think it's really important that we pay attention to how this unfolds.
Yeah, and the United States has enjoyed scientific supremacy for decades, has invested heavily through federal funding in scientific infrastructure since the close of the Second World War. And all of that will be in jeopardy, obviously, if that investment is subject to a substantial decrease. I don't know that the rest of the world has the resources to make up for the type of reduction in investment that is contemplated in the current U.S. federal budget. So I think everyone will suffer as a result. The U.S. will potentially suffer from brain drain if it becomes more attractive for scientists to work elsewhere. But I don't think that this is a winner-takes-all phenomenon, scientific advances in general. I think that the world as a whole benefits from U.S. leadership in the sciences, and I would certainly like to see that continue.
Absolutely. Well, we hope that it does. And you know, I think we'll just continue to follow this closely and try to think about ways that we can help continue to advance the progress of the industry. And I think with that, we probably should wrap up. I really want to, Matt and I really want to thank both you, Ari, and Kasala for joining us today and sharing some information about PROF. And there are places people can go to find out more about that. It's a public GitHub. Salik, would you mind just reminding us what is the address that people can go to find information about PROF?
In GitHub, you can see prof-project.github.io.
All right, excellent.
And let me mention also that there is a associated research paper co-authored by Kasala and also members of my colleague Andrew Miller's group that you can easily find online just by Googling doing a search on the title of the paper, which is PROF, Protected Order Flow in a Profit-Seeking World.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you both for joining us and look forward to learning more about what you're doing in the future.
Thanks very much for having me on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, guys. We'll see you soon. Thank you.
Crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2025 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.